The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. I hope everyone is doing well today. Our first article comes from the Wellness section, How to Shed a Label That No Longer Serves You. Was it given to you by a nasty tween in school, or the sharp voice in your own head that's stuck on a loop? Here's how to rip it off for good. This article is by Jamie Kern Lima. We hide behind labels and hide because of labels. Labels someone gave us once and we let stick. Labels we've given ourselves. And now, with technology, even the labels of ratings that strangers give us online. It's so easy to confuse fake labels with real identities. The labels you've let stick to you and that you believe about yourself impact your entire life. When well-meaning family and friends give us teasing labels, they have no idea how easy it is for those labels to take root. Before we know it, we've internalized the disempowering labels we've heard from others, and more commonly, the disempowering labels we've placed on ourselves. We think these labels define us. We think everyone else sees them, too. These labels are only words, at best, usually outdated, and at worst, complete lies. But they have the power to make us disappear and feel unworthy. I was conceived during a one-time encounter between two people who were never together again. I was kept a secret before I was placed into adoption the day I was born. I could be tempted to see my own story with labels like unwanted or secret or mistake or abandoned. But what I know to be true is that God never left me. What I chose to believe, what I know in every ounce of my being, is that God stamped me with the biggest, most special, and beautiful of labels. Labels that say wanted, more than enough, my precious girl, wonderfully made, called, qualified, worthy. And I imagine a giant stamp right across my forehead that says chosen. I know that he has stamped every single one of us with these same words, too. Deciding to remove those labels and choose new ones that match your worthiness is transformative. I would like to invite you to do an exercise on labels that is intended to bring awareness and then empowerment. Below, you'll see three columns. And there are three columns together in a dark purple. The first one says disempowering label, and there are four lines below it. And the second part says, what has believing this label cost you? What impact has it had on every area of your life? And there are four lines under that. And then the third one is new empowering replacement label / belief, and there are four lines below that. In the first column, I want you to write down the disempowering labels you've given yourself, the false ones that maybe you never let anyone know you believe, but you do. Maybe they're labels like failure, unlovable, unqualified, not funny, coward, unattractive, too old, too young, unworthy, damaged, rejected, hesitant, not smart enough. Now for the middle column. This might be the hardest thing you do today, but perhaps the most important. Next to each label, I want you to write what believing that label has cost you in life. What has it cost you in your relationships? What has believing that label cost you in your job or ambitions? What has it cost you in your joy? Then go deeper. For example, did the label not only cost you the thing, but then also the confidence to go for the next thing? Or, if a label cost you your voice in a relationship, did that then snowball into you not speaking up in friendships? Finally, in the third right-hand column, I want you to write a replacement belief for that disempowering label, something you know is true about the core and essence of who you are, something that your creator would say about you, or your best friend would say, something that you know in your soul to be true about yourself, a new label or new belief that you want to replace that old one with. Maybe if your old label is unlovable, maybe your new label is worthy of love. If your old label is deficient, maybe your new label is resilient. It's the real you, the you you were born as, before the world and people-pleasing and hate and hurt and judgment and self-doubt taught you who to be. Reinforce these new labels in creative ways until they take root. Set one or two of the new labels as daily reminders on your cell phone, so when the alarm sounds off and you glance down, you are reminded of your new, true label. Write them in permanent marker on the tags inside your favorite clothing. Disempowering labels feel heavy, like you're wearing badges of lies all over you. Removing these labels permanently feels like truth and freedom. Embracing empowering and true labels feels like energy, an uplifting wind beneath your wings. Labels are made up, and they can be unmade up. They can be removed. And there's a book that accompanies this article. It's called Worthy: How to Believe You Are Enough and Transform Your Life. Simple Steps, Life-Changing Results. And it's by the New York Times best-selling author Jamie, J-A-M-I-E, Kern, K-E-R-N, and the last name is Lima, L-I-M-A, and this book is $17 at Amazon. Hey, we're over in Oprah's Insider section, Oprah on the Sweetness of the Season. And this is by Oprah Winfrey. Hello, insiders. Summer is in full swing, and I am in entertaining mode. I just love to bring people together. For me, that's what this season is all about. I'll never forget the garden party I once hosted for some girlfriends. I wanted it to be like a scene from a Merchant Ivory film. We wore fancy hats, sat on chairs covered in taffeta and yellow silk bows, and dined on shrimp salad and peach tartlets, washed down with lavender lemonade. It was an unforgettable experience. But summer gatherings don't have to be grand to be special. I've had some of my most memorable meals at home with friends, family, and two simple ingredients, great laughs and good food. It's the coming together that matters. If you need inspiration, there are some delicious recipes up on the site right now. There's a menu of cucumber melon soup, slow-roasted pastirma-style ribeyes, and an olive oil cake from Chef Jose Andreas, whom I admire so deeply for his humanitarian work. Or, if you want to feel like you're on vacation on a Greek island, try whipping up some spanakopita fritters or burnt butter eggs and goat's cheese for brunch. I'm also eyeing this zucchini carpaccio, which is almost too pretty to eat. However you're spending your Sunday, I hope you enjoy the season and eat some good food surrounded by good people. Wishing you a great week, everybody. We're over in the word of the week, revenge bedtime procrastination. This might be why you've been yawning all day. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Picture this. You're in bed after a long day and you're exhausted, but you can't stop scrolling Instagram, perusing TikTok, or deep diving into your middle school best friend's Facebook wedding photos. You're not alone. In dark bedrooms everywhere, people are telling themselves one more story, one more reel, one more video, one more BOGO sale. But it's never just one. And this time suck is called revenge bedtime procrastination. A recent survey found that 80% of people have lost sleep due to this addictive experience. And another found that 74% of social media use happens before bed. Let's break it down. The bedtime and procrastination parts should be obvious. You're putting off sleep by devouring a full season of Friends. Revenge, though? Essentially, you feel like you had zero time to yourself all day, and the unending scroll feels like a few stolen moments or hours that you've earned, even if you know it's not fulfilling to watch videos of vegan recipes you will never make. We know it feels good at the time, but not the next morning when your alarm goes off after just 4 hours of shut-eye. Next time, do your best to avoid the social media vortex. Yes, a few episodes of Ross chasing after Rachel, again, are okay if you find them comforting. But for a truly restorative night, read our tips on getting the best sleep without leaving your phone in another room. Sweet dreams. This next article comes from the relationships section. The moment I got what it means to be treated well in a relationship. For a recently divorced woman, accepting a kind gesture led to the biggest emotional breakthrough of her life. This article is by Amy Sheem. When I started casually dating after my divorce, I joked that I was having fun because I had no standards. I didn't actually mean that the people I was dating were low-quality people, or that I was willing to be, or was being, treated badly. Really, I just meant that I wasn't looking for anything in particular, and thus I was undisappointable. Things that upset my fellow divorcee friends of the "he never texted back" or "she's still enmeshed with her ex" variety seemed to slide right off my Teflon heart. When I had a drink with someone who monologued about her soccer league and never once asked me what I'd like to do, I came away thinking, I just learned so much about adult soccer leagues. When I became entangled with someone who could never or would never make a plan ahead of time, I thought, this is an interesting experiment in how spontaneous I can be. The answer turned out to be not very. Was I numbed out, or had I become a Zen master? Why not both? In my emotionally bruised post-marriage state, I liked the idea of being independent, of not needing anyone. Plus, my religious upbringing, by which I mean being Gen X, had me convinced that there's nothing better than being a detached, cool girl, and that there was something romantic about bad relationships defined by communication problems. What took me a little longer to grasp was that being independent doesn't have to mean not wanting anything from anyone. Cut to, I'm having a stressful day. My new girlfriend, Sarah, observes my stress, asks if she can stop by to bring me a coffee from the nearby cafe, and breaks my brain. It might help to have this context. One, we have been dating for only a few months, and two, while I'd dated women before, my serious relationships had all been with men. Relevant here? Jury is out. Oh, and three, when she arrived with the coffee, it had milk in it. I couldn't believe it. You remembered that I like milk in my coffee? Of course, she said slowly. Like you would when talking to a shy cat. We've had coffee together before. But you don't even drink coffee. In a past relationship, I'd been informed that my partner couldn't remember my simple coffee order because he himself was not a coffee drinker, and I had absorbed this learning, like the good student of a bad teacher. But you do. And I don't know, I noticed that you put milk in it. That's like bare minimum. When I told both single and married friends about this, however, they agreed that this was, in fact, an amazingly kind thing. The intuition, the offer, the execution. 10/10 early dating moves. This isn't to say that no one I'd dated before had done thoughtful things. Sometimes, honestly, they wanted to and I wouldn't let them. A couple years ago, had a romantic partner offered to bring me coffee in the middle of the day, I probably would have felt irritated. I didn't want anyone to know how I liked my coffee. You get that the coffee is a metaphor, right? Because I'm not sure I did. Sarah thinks I'm ridiculous when I lose my mind with gratitude when she, for example, wants to drop off tea and cough drops on my porch when my kids and I are sick. She laughs when I tell her it's incredible that she asks how a meeting went or that she recalls my friend's backstory. But for a long time, while I had been able to imagine many other aspects of a romantic entanglement, this kind of desire for everyday thoughtfulness and observation seemed out of reach. But now I know that letting a partner give you what you want, letting them see you and know you, even when you're not at your best, is actually a form of self-care, and that it allows you to care more for them in return. This is another article in the relationships section. The most popular person you know is also lonely. From the outside, Ash Sanders' life seemed like one big party. Inside, she was barely keeping it together. This article is by Ash Sanders. It was my 40th birthday. At the abandoned farm I'd rented in upstate New York, the house was quiet and gloomy. A few dozen people dressed in morning clothes sat in rows of seats waiting. I was behind one of the curtains with a group of friends in dark veils. "Ready?" one of them asked me. I nodded. They pressed play on the loudspeaker, and the room filled with the organ track from The Phantom of the Opera. I lay down on a pallet, and my friends picked me up and bore me into a large room. They walked me to the front and put me in a coffin. Now the party could begin. The people gathered in the audience were there for my mock funeral. The email invite I'd sent out months ago had explained everything. "You are cordially invited to celebrate my life and my rebirth." A friend dressed in black robes emceed. "Here lies Ash," she said, "lover of a party." One after the other, 30 of my friends took turns on the mic, eulogizing me. After everyone shed some crocodile tears, it was time for the promised comeback. Suddenly, the room filled with Madonna. My pallbearers ripped off their veils and robes to reveal bedazzled corsets. After my brief demise, I was reborn to a choreographed group dance to Like a Prayer. The crowd went wild. I've always had a thing for parties. When I was 8, I saved up my allowance money and sent off for a book called The Penny Whistle Party Planner. Following it to a T, I organized an Olympics-themed party with invitations shaped like rings and a 6-part sports tournament. I planned a cowboy party that culminated in a dramatized shootout under a wide western sky. Weeks before each party, I'd give my mom an invite list. "But this is everyone in your class," she'd say. And I'd nod. Of course it was. The funeral party was my brainchild. It was also my redemption. 2 years prior, I'd gone through a brutal divorce, and I'd been reeling ever since. In the mornings, I woke up with so much anxiety that I vomited in the sink. At the college where I taught writing, I'd cry quietly in the bathroom before teaching 19-year-olds about the essentials of sentence structure. In defiance of my grief, I stacked my calendar with parties and plans. But at night, when I came home and closed the door, my apartment pulsed with quiet. I'd let myself go full fetal on the mattress, the tears coming in great sheets. On the other side of the bed, the emptiness was so palpable. It felt like a presence. Some nights I felt an urgent need for someone to braid my hair, their competent hands pulling and twisting, the feeling of being mothered, but there was no one there to ask. I wanted to believe I was over the divorce. I wanted other people to believe it too. I wanted to say goodbye to the dread, the feeling of walking in an endless, ever-tightening spiral. My friends who got divorced at the same time were back on the dating scene, regaling me with their loves at first sight and marathon first dates. I felt like the only person who had unraveled and couldn't ravel herself back again. To compensate, I put on a good face. I told my own stories of dates and crushes. But mostly, I threw parties. One night, my friends and I turned one of our houses into an art gallery and asked people to contribute something outside their usual creative wheelhouse. On opening night, my friend played her amateur skate video on a loop in the corner. Another staged a fashion line inspired by her daughter's old dolls. I'd spent days making a fortune teller's booth with silver walls and mirrored stickers. "Wow," one woman said when I gave her marriage advice. "You're really good at this." "But I'm not," I wanted to tell her. "I can't see my own future at all." It was easy to tell people I was sad about a breakup. People understand that. What was harder to admit was that, despite my large circle of friends and brimming social life, I was terribly, awfully, unbearably lonely. Because loneliness felt like a failure, a secret. No one else seemed to be feeling it, so I assumed I was the only one who did. Besides, the loneliness I was feeling was hard to explain. It had less to do with wanting someone in particular, and more to do with the fact that, partnered or not, happy or not, we come home each night to ourselves, to that impossible want at the center of us that no other person can fill. After my funeral party, I posted pictures of me in my coffin. In the caption, I told everyone how the groundskeeper had built it for me in his wood shop when the coffin I ordered didn't arrive. I posted a boomerang of me dancing to Madonna, my hands in the air, my black hoop skirt swishing. "She's back," I wrote. I got a lot of DMs after that. "Your life is better than TV," one woman said. I started to message her back, "Ha ha," I wrote, and then erased it. Because the truth was, I was not back. In fact, I was so not back that my friends encouraged me to sign up for intensive outpatient therapy, where I was diagnosed with OCD. "Some OCD people are afraid of contamination," my therapist told me. I, on the other hand, was a social perfectionist. I was afraid to admit that I was ever insecure, that I was ever hurt, ever lonely. She called this version of me Dazzling Ash. Dazzling Ash was going to try to be impressive, even in an outpatient program, she said. Her goal, she told me, was to help me realize that I was just like everyone else. For weeks, I tried to be impressive anyway. Sure, I was sad, but at least I was funny about it. I brought a party energy to the whole bleak strip mall establishment. But I didn't feel any better. I went to group therapy 3 hours a day, every weekday, for 3 months. The goal of the program was to get all of us to do the things that scared us most, to prove to ourselves that they would not, in fact, kill us, that we would survive them. I threw myself into most of the exercises. I turned in subpar work to an editor and submitted a resume with obvious errors. I gave speeches in front of the whole group about mistakes I'd made. I was challenging my perfectionism in every way but one. I couldn't give up on Dazzling Ash. She was my revenge for all the pain of the divorce. If I lost her, I'd have to admit I was alone. One day, weeks into my treatment, a new client approached me shyly. They were dressed in a Bass Pro Shops fishing hat and camo overalls, eyes down, gnawing on their lip ring. They'd clearly been assigned this task by their therapist, clearly afraid of something they'd been challenged to confront, and they were clearly dreading it. "I was wondering if you could tell me about a difficult breakup you've gone through," they said without looking up. At first I balked. I didn't want to interact with a person whose need was so strong it seemed to gas off of them. I didn't want to expose my pain to a stranger in a gray room in a stucco building next to a burger joint. I wanted to be casual and cool and say something snarky about love. I wanted to show them that I was fine. Great, actually. But instead, I started to cry. "It's so hard," I said to this person I barely knew. "It's so hard." Somewhere in my brain, something was screaming at me to stop, certain that if I kept going, I would ruin the story I'd been telling about myself for the past several years, the flattery, dazzling one I thought would make me happy. But I was exhausted by that story, and besides, it wasn't true. The stranger in the camo was startled by my tears at first, but soon they scooted close to me and patted my head with their wonderful hands. It was quiet for a long time. "I am lonely," I said into the large gray room, and it was the scariest thing I have ever said. "Me too," they said. "I am lonely too." And then we didn't say anything at all. I spent years thinking I was different from everyone else, certain that I was worse than everyone. I tried to convince everyone that I was better, or if not better, then at least that there was nobody quite like me. But perhaps, as my therapist suggested, the real truth is that I'm not special at all, that every day people just like me are putting on their camo pants and fishing hats and heading out the door nurturing a secret and terrible fear that they're not like other people, certain that this makes them inferior and unworthy. Perhaps there are people who are just as lonely as I am, who've done the same strained things I have to compensate for their solitude. Perhaps I've been dragging my history around behind me like tin cans, making a terrible noise I was convinced no one else could hear. But perhaps everyone else does too. Perhaps our wounded and combined cacophonies are a language beneath language, the words we want to say but cannot bear to admit. When I threw my funeral party, I thought I needed to show everyone how well I was doing. I thought I had to come back to life to feel better. I thought there had to be sequins and pictures and friends oohing and aahing. I wasn't lonely, I insisted. I had too many friends and too many plans. But the truth is, there are never enough friends to solve your loneliness. That's not how it works. What does work? What helps at least a little is knowing that everyone else is lonely too. Because loneliness is not something you do alone. It's something you share with other people. It's the party that everyone's invited to. This article is over in books. Viola Davis and James Patterson are co-writing a novel. The collaboration between the author of Oprah's 95th book club pick, Finding Me, and the best-selling novelist will be set in the present-day American South. And this article is by Charlie Burlock. This is not a drill. Viola Davis, the EGOT-winning Oprah's book club author, has just announced that she will be publishing a second full-length book, and that it will be co-written by the legendary James Patterson. This is the stuff book lovers' dreams are made of. Oprah selected Davis's Finding Me for her book club back in 2022, calling it one of the most powerful memoirs I have ever read. This forthcoming collaboration will be Davis's first work of adult fiction. Patterson has had a bit more experience with the genre. He is the author of more than 200 books, 100 of which have become New York Times bestsellers. His best-known works include The Women's Murder Club, Michael Bennett, and, of course, the Alex Cross series, which was adapted into 3 feature films starring Morgan Freeman, and later Tyler Perry as the titular detective. Aldous Hodge is set to take on the iconic character in an upcoming Amazon Prime Video series. James's ability to weave compelling narratives with depth and suspense is unparalleled, says Davis. This skill will undoubtedly come in handy with this latest work, which tells the story of a female judge by the name of Mary Stone on the precipice of making a decision that will inevitably shake her small southern county and perhaps the whole country. There has rarely been a more important time to spotlight the subjects raised in this novel, says Patterson. I could not have asked for a better partner than Viola. Like Oprah, Patterson was floored by finding me and says that Davis's gift of storytelling in film and beyond, as well as her generous spirit, is without peer. Davis trusts that readers will be deeply moved by Judge Mary Stone's story. This collaboration is a dream come true, and I can't wait to share the fruits of our creative synergy with the world, she says. While the publisher, Little Brown & Company, has yet to announce the official publication date, we can expect the hardcover to hit shelves sometime in 2025 or 2026, along with a simultaneous ebook and audiobook release. Davis won a Grammy for her audiobook narration of Finding Me. Is it too much to hope that she might step into the recording booth again for this new novel? Over in Culture and News, Meghan Markle exudes easy elegance in halterneck gown for surprise red carpet appearance. She looked glamorous alongside Prince Harry and Serena Williams at the 2024 ESPY Awards. This article is by Chelsea Sanchez. Surprise! Duchess Meghan and Prince Harry made a rare public appearance at the 2024 ESPY Awards in Los Angeles on July 11. The couple showed up to the Dolby Theater, where Meghan's close friend Serena Williams will take the stage as the ceremony's host. There, Harry accepted the Pat Tillman Award, which is honoring his work through the Invictus Games. The trio posed together for pictures on the red carpet. Meghan looked effortlessly elegant in a sleek white gown from Staud with a draped halterneck, a backless silhouette, and a floor-sweeping hemline. She kept her accessories to a minimum, simply adding diamond stud earrings, her signature gold Cartier bracelet, and a few gold diamond-encrusted rings. Finally, she finished off the look with strappy black heels. Beauty-wise, she opted for a natural glam and swept her black hair up into a slicked-back bun. As for Harry, the Duke of Sussex looked suave in a classic black suit from Giorgio Armani, worn with a white collared shirt and black tie. Williams looked just as glamorous in her own halterneck gown, a custom Ferragamo creation. Though she took a more sparkly route, her dress was nearly entirely covered in reflective maroon scales. The piece's skirt additionally featured wine-colored fringe enmeshed with the scales. The tennis champ and the Duchess of Sussex have long held a close friendship with each other over the years. Back in 2022, Williams sat down with Meghan for the debut episode of her podcast, Archetypes. She couldn't be a better friend to me. Low moments, high moments, she's always there, and that's all I want to be to her, the athlete previously said of the Duchess in a 2019 press conference. Going on in Culture and News, Today Show fans cheer on Hoda Kotb as she marks career milestone on Instagram. The TV host is celebrating 50 episodes of her hit podcast, Making Space with Hoda Kotb. This article is by Adriana Friedman. Hoda Kotb is marking a major moment in her career, and she's invited one of the biggest names in country music to celebrate with her. On July 10, the Today Show host went on Instagram to proudly announce her podcast, Making Space with Hoda Kotb. Reached an incredible 50 episodes. As Kotb uploaded a video reflecting on the milestone, she shared how the journey has affected the way she looks at the world and humanity overall. Hey guys, I'm so excited to drop the 50th episode of Making Space, she emotionally said in the clip. I was just reflecting on all the seasons, and I'm just honored to be able to talk to all these incredible people. I think what I learned is, well, first of all, you only get one life. I only get one life, and we can only learn our life lessons. What I love is we have all of these people who are sharing all of their wisdom and all of their life lessons that we can apply in our lives, which is super cool, she added. Some things I'd have never thought of then, and suddenly they become part of my life. The other thing I learned, really, is most of my favorite guests have really kind of been through hell and back and ended up on top. So I hope you enjoy this, and I'm happy you guys are with me and on this ride, she concluded. When fans saw the host getting personal about her latest career achievement, they rushed to the comments to send kind words. Listening to your podcast, and I'm so proud of you, one person wrote. What a beautiful and heartwarming message, another replied. I so enjoy your podcast. Thank you for making us think, a different follower added. Folks may remember Hoda first started her Making Space podcast back in September of 2021. She has had a number of famous faces join her on the show, including Jenna Bush Hager, Celine Dion, and Savannah Guthrie. As for who she talks to on the 50th episode, she and country superstar Lainey Wilson get personal about Wilson's journey to making it big in music. If y'all can't tell by these pictures, I'm obsessed with at Hoda Kotb, Wilson posted on Instagram on July 10. You're a hoot and a half, sister. It was the biggest honor to be the 50th guest for your podcast, Making Space, and if it was up to me, I'd join ya every day. Thank you for having me on to gush about my love for songwriting and my journey. Y'all go check out our episode now. Congrats, Hoda, and here's to 50 more. Over in Lifestyle, we have Trips That Transform. Here at Oprah Daily, we believe that travel, whether a day trip to a state park or a trip of a lifetime, safari to Africa, might be the ultimate catalyst for change, clarity, and growth. Here, a collection of stories that changed the lives of our favorite travel muses forever. And this is by Pilar Guzman. We recently asked our Oprah Daily community what their greatest act of self-care would be if time and resources weren't a barrier. All responses resoundingly and unequivocally involved some form of travel. But beyond the usual bucket list suspects, African safari, Taj Mahal, the Galapagos, we were pleasantly surprised by the overwhelming desire for experiences that facilitate personal transformation, the kinds of mind-expanding, soul-feeding, relationship-deepening journeys, both solo and with loved ones, that remind them of what really matters. We heard a lot about the desire to do walking trips as a way to connect with nature and invite a spiritual awakening, the urge to retrace one's ancestry, however painful the journey in some cases, and a growing sense of urgency to gather friends, children, and grandchildren in one place, even if only for a few days. We understood that in a moment of intense polarization around the globe, so many of us yearn for experiences that remind us of our shared humanity. As Maya Angelou once said, Perhaps travel cannot prevent bigotry, but by demonstrating that all people cry, laugh, eat, worry, and die, it can introduce the idea that if we try and understand each other, we may even become friends. If you've been following along with Oprah these past few years, you've likely been living vicariously through her travels around the world. But even beyond the dreamy destinations, from her Cradle of Civilization pilgrimage to Petra, to her first visit to Japan to see the cherry blossoms, to her girls' spa week in Italy, what strikes us most about these trips isn't so much the where, although each voyage is more dazzling than the last, or even the how, so much as the with whom, and of course the why. Because life is better when you share it, I believe, says Oprah. As we've witnessed when the world reopened post-pandemic, she was ready to be in it again, but pretty much only if she could be with a handful of her besties. Because for those of us like Oprah who love adventure as much as we love the homes and people we get to return to, the stakes for a good trip are even higher. My forever life mantra is aligned with Dorothy's from The Wizard of Oz. There's no place like home. I have purposely created beautiful spaces because I'm at heart a homebody, Oprah says. So when I do venture beyond my own backyard, I like traveling with a purpose. For her, and so many of us who are always on the go, the perennial question is, what is worth the time, energy, and expense of leaving the hard-won sanctuary of one's own home? Even though travel is by definition a luxury, it also comes with the pressure to narrow the universe of possibilities and choose that one perfect trip guaranteed to make them to make memories, create a much-needed shift in perspective, and maybe even change our lives. For guidance, we turn to some of our favorite in-the-know friends, contributors, and travel muses, people whose pivotal travel memories inspire us to identify what really makes us tick and to stretch beyond our comfort zones, and whose recommendations we squirrel away for when we are ready. For us, beyond the magic of the locals, travel is all about the ways in which our eyes, ears, and souls get imprinted forever after and turn into stories that we'll tell for years to come. I love to combine work and play, so whenever I'm invited to speak across the globe, I book a few days before so I can explore, meet people, and enjoy whatever food they're offering, Oprah says. And then I incorporate those encounters or anecdotes into my conversations. Pilar Guzman, editorial director, Oprah Daily. Gail King, editor-at-large, Oprah Daily. In early 2000, I got to see the Big Five, lion, rhino, buffalo, leopard, elephant, in South Africa, and all the other smaller animals, hyenas, gazelles, impalas, roaming free in their own habitat. I never felt the same about going to the zoo. It suddenly seemed cruel and inhumane to keep these majestic animals locked up in cages just so we could gawk. It changed my relationship to animals forever after. Yolanda Edwards, founder, YOLO Journal. We were invited last minute to join friends traveling on the Nile with Nour El Nil, a fleet of traditional dahabiyas that strike just the right balance of bohemian luxury and cultural immersion as they make their way from Luxor to Aswan. There was this one moment when we were led through the village of Aswan, with the guide encouraged us not to stop as locals swarmed us. I have often struggled with the discomfort of stealing myself and became momentarily hardened when faced with so much poverty and need. While most of the crowd had fallen off as we made our way to the desert, a few kids kept following us. One young boy who was 5 years old and accompanied by his 3-year-old brother asked my name. I asked for theirs in return. They giggled and beamed at me with the sweetest smiles you can imagine. As we left town and walked through the sand dunes, the kids kept following us, scaling the high rocks and calling my name from ever greater distances. At one point, they appeared atop a super high rock across the desert, and the boys raised their hands and yelled, "Yolanda!" I had tears in my eyes and called back to them, our voices echoing in tandem across the lunar landscape. I felt seen and saw in a way that other sorts of prescriptive bucket list travel and our busy, busy lives don't allow for. I realized in that moment just how desensitized I'd become despite myself. Of all the travel I do for a living, this was a personal highlight. I was so happy that I let down my guard and was able to experience the purity of human connection across cultural and linguistic barriers. Sheila Bridges, Principal, Sheila Bridges Design. I first went to Iceland with a group of friends for my 50th. For me, it was instantly transformative. There was something about the country that kept calling me back, so much so that the following year I ended up buying a home there. It's definitely not for everyone, though it's much easier to get there than people realize, and an easy stopover on my frequent trips to Europe. As a creative person, so much of it had to do with the light, the landscape, nature, and people that never stop feeding my curiosity, and the horses. The geothermal waters are truly healing. It's the place where I feel instant escape, my true happy place. Athena Calderon, designer, author, and founder, I Swoon. The first time we visited the Aeolian Islands as a family in 2014 completely shifted how we saw the world and engaged with one another. My husband, Victor, is Sicilian, so first and foremost, it was incredible to be in the motherland for 10 days together. I can just remember how everything slowed down. It tends to do that in Italy anyway, but in the remote Aeolian Islands, it truly feels like a different world. Being so far removed from reality in our day-to-day routines made us connect more, laugh more, adventure more, dream more, and open our hearts up more. Our son, Javon, was at such a pivotal age. I can distinctly remember Victor speaking in his native Sicilian dialect on the island of Salina, and witnessing the pure joy and awe on Javon's face at seeing this different version of his dad. Each day we would rent a small boat from a Sicilian local, hop in and set off for hours, sometimes all day. No captain here, just the three of us on adventures across the deep blue crystalline sea, visiting different islands. I can still hear the laughter and feel the joy as we sped across the expansive sea with the salty water spraying Javon's small body as he sat at the front of the boat, his long hair tousled. I will never forget steering into this cove with big black lava stones and diving into the deep turquoise water, or the time we approached the island of Stromboli and watched the smoke from the active volcano. I vividly recall Javon's excitement of seeing the rich black sand, the lava stones, and just the sheer magnitude of his surroundings that felt so far removed from his life in the city. When we weren't on the water, we were whipping around the winding roads on a moped, inhaling the salt air and soaking up the red sky as the sun slid into the sea. Afterward, we'd sit together on the back deck overlooking Stromboli for dinner, exhausted and exhilarated, as we recounted the day's events with such enthusiasm. We played I Spy with my little eye, usually spying lemon or fig trees or cacti. And everything felt so perfect, so present, so precious. I remember wanting to bottle up the purity of the moment. There was such a deep level of connection. There's nothing like being on an adventure in a place that forces you to slow down and allows you to connect with your family more. It really puts everything into perspective. Adam Glassman, Creative Director, Oprah Daily. When I do go on vacation, I like to go in with a sense of purpose. After hearing about it for years, I finally went to the famous Viva Mer in Austria, a luxury medical detox and wellness resort that focuses on prevention and is set in the most gorgeous part of the Austrian Alps. Detoxification is at the heart of this program, with a big emphasis on rest and cleansing of the digestive system. The philosophy being that health and the immune system originate in the gut, and that the combination of detoxifying treatments, the reduction of inflammation, and holistic therapies can help reset it. I got a big re-education on exercise and eating habits. I was encouraged, for example, to chew my food 40 to 60 times per bite to ensure proper digestion, even when eating soup, and learned about all the ways in which digestion impacts everything from weight and circulation to skin and headaches. But after a week of truly unplugging, hiking in the mountains in between treatments, the greatest takeaway was the importance of rest. Each guest is assigned to a doctor and gets thorough diagnostics and an individualized program, which includes medical appointments, IV drips, foot baths, mud wraps, nasal reflexology, Watsu water therapy, Pilates, myofascial therapy, breathwork, osteopathy, salt scrubs, cryotherapy, sessions with oxygen tanks, and flushing of the liver and stomach with Epsom salts, all of which are designed to help release energy blockages and emotional buildups. Ultimately, the program purges the body of toxins, and as the week went on, I felt euphoric. By the end, I left feeling rested and full of energy, and with real learnings to take back to the real world. Both a physical and emotional detox, my time there was life-changing. It reminded me of the importance of taking care of myself, giving myself permission to rest, and to take an actual vacation a few times a year to enjoy life, and to do the kind of exercise that is actually fun, walking with friends outdoors, not punishing. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Back over in culture and news, a sequel to The Devil Wears Prada is finally in the works. There's nothing to say except, gird your loins. This article is by Bianca Betancourt. Did we just smack our little heads on the pavement? Because we can't believe we're actually saying it, but a sequel to The Devil Wears Prada is reportedly finally in the works. According to Puck and Variety, a sequel to the 2006 hit comedy has finally received an official green light from Disney, and Meryl Streep, who portrayed the fabulous Ice Queen editor-in-chief Miranda Priestly, has also reportedly signed on to come back, along co-star Emily Blunt. Anne Hathaway's involvement in the upcoming sequel is unclear, though we can't really imagine a proper sequel without her anti-fashionista take on Andy Sachs. Over the years, Hathaway has expressed doubt about a sequel coming to fruition, at least with her involved. Screenwriter Aline Broche McKenna is also set to return and was reportedly a key factor in securing Streep's participation. Disney declined comment on the status of the sequel. According to Puck, the sequel will follow Priestley as the runway editor faces the dystopian post-aughts realities of the magazine business and goes head-to-head with her former assistant, Emily Charlton Blunt, now a high-powered executive at a Kering or LVMH-style luxury group whose advertising dollars Priestley desperately needs. Fans of the original film, of course, were quick to express their excitement and hesitation over the news of a sequel. "We'd firmly put The Devil Wears Prada on our unofficial list of absolutely perfect movies that should never be touched again. But with potentially the entire original cast on board, maybe the magic can be created just one more time. Watch this space for updates." Again in culture and news, today fans' hearts melt seeing Al Roker's emotional note to his granddaughter. The TV host's granddaughter, Skye, celebrated her first birthday, and he had feelings about it. This article is by Adriana Friedman. In what fans could only call a heart-melting moment, Al Roker is paying tribute to the littlest love of his life. On July 3, the Today Show host went on Instagram to announce and celebrate his granddaughter Skye's first birthday. Her mother is Roker's daughter, Courtney Roker Laga. Roker uploaded a precious video montage of Skye, beginning with her as a newborn in the hospital and showing her growing over her first year. He also marked the occasion with an emotional tribute in the caption about how his life changed with her birth. "At 11:41 a.m. a year ago today, I got to fall in love all over again in a very special way. He affectionately captioned the photo as Stevie Wonder's "Isn't She Lovely" playing in the background. Thanks at OUICHEFROKER and at THATTEACHERWHODJS for the gift of this special girl, Sky. When fans saw Roker share a public display of affection for his only grandchild, it didn't take long before folks celebrated alongside him. "Yes, happy first birthday, beautiful, sweet Sky," one person wrote in the comments. "How is she a year? So beautiful," another declared. "Happiest birthday, precious little girl. Your pop-pop is seriously smitten." "Just the best gift ever," a different follower added. Roker has been vocal about the impact Sky made in his life since she was born. While hosting the July 9 taping of the Today Show, he opened up about a recent milestone she reached. "We had Sky's first birthday on the 3rd, he explained to his fellow co-stars in a video posted on TikTok. "It was fun because she started crawling this weekend at the house. She's doing, you know, the army crawl, and then she does this, what we call the zombies, and then she keeps crawling, and I mean, now she's like gone. Now we got to start baby-proofing." What an adorable moment. Here's a gift idea, Red Bay Coffee Holiday Gift Set. This ethically sourced coffee, 8-ounce bags, each of Motherland, East 14th, and Carver's Dream flavors, is roasted in small batches in Oakland, California for a smooth taste. It's $16 at Amazon. You can also buy it at Red Bay Coffee. Another possible purchase is the original mortgage apple cake. In 2009, facing the loss of her house, this founder started selling her apple cakes to pay off her loan. It worked, and we know why. There wasn't a crumb left after our tasting. You can get it for $90 at Amazon. You can also get it at maccakes.com, M-A-C-C-A-K-E-S. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.